You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. A little later in the program, we'll be joined by WPR's news guy, Noah Ovshinsky. He'll give us a recap of the state's top news stories from this week.
First, this music is putting us in the mood to talk about robots and the like. Have you ever watched an animated movie and felt a little creeped out because the characters are a little too realistic looking? There's a chance you've fallen into what they call the uncanny valley, the idea that more lifelike a creation, an animated character or robot, the more likely it is to cross the line from cute to creepy.
Our next guest, this has been the golden rule for robotics for decades, but questions are now being raised as to whether the uncanny valley actually exists.
Joining us now is Rose Eveleth. She's a producer, writer, and designer based in Brooklyn. Her piece, Robots, Is the Uncanny Valley Real?, appeared on BBC.com. Rose, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's the history? Where did the idea of the uncanny valley come from?
So the idea was originally proposed by a Japanese scientist called Masahiro Mori in 1970. Some people will point back to 1906 when a philosopher, Ernst Jensch, wrote about it, but really what we think of as the uncanny valley was proposed in the 70s. And the surprising thing about it was that it was proposed and then sort of never questioned. Everyone just sort of, I guess, read it and thought, yeah, you know, that makes sense. And it wasn't until recently that people started to actually look into whether this was a single phenomenon or even real at all.
So the notion, and I think I explained it right, is that as you take a cartoon character from, say, looking like Charlie Brown to looking more and more like a human, you reach a point where it gets creepy. And I'm thinking Polar Express here, which I found a little creepy, and it was trying to get that image captured of what a person looks like. Is that a pretty good summary of what the Uncanny Valley is?
Yeah, exactly. And Polar Express is a classic example that people use. Another one is Final Fantasy from 2001. And this applies to video games, too, and also robots, the humanoid robots that you might see in real life. So, I mean, it sort of cuts across all different kinds of imagery.
And do designers of these various genres say, all right, we need to make things a little less realistic so we don't cross the line there?
Yeah, a lot of them do. There's sort of a split between designers who say, we don't care, we're going to try to make things as realistic as possible. So there are some robot designers who say, no, I'm going to try to make as realistic of a robot as possible. And then there are a lot of people who say the opposite. They say, you know, I'd rather not people be totally repulsed by the thing that I make, and I'm going to try to avoid that. So Pixar is a classic example of that. They often sort of skew to the more cartoon side of things to avoid falling into sort of the Polar Express trap of making these characters that are just too lifelike for us.
Well, that's the idea, but you write that the Uncanny Valley, the problem with it is that it's an inherently woolly idea. What do you mean by that?
So the really interesting thing about the Uncanny Valley is that the first paper, this paper from 1970, wasn't even really a scientific paper to begin with. It was sort of a proposal. It was Mori saying, I think that this is what it's like, and here's a graph that I think is going to describe how people feel. It was originally written in Japanese, and in fact, the translation, the Uncanny Valley, the translation of that, is debated. The actual translation that's closest to reality is the Valley of Eeriness. And there's a big question about what it means for something to be uncanny and whether or not the translations that we've used, things like uncanny and likability, like how much we like something, are the right ones to be using. And for a scientist, when you're looking at a complex emotion like that weird feeling that we feel when we see a Polar Express or a humanoid robot, they're trying to figure out if it's one phenomena or more than one. And it's hard to do that when no one's even defining the emotion the same way. And so that's what makes it sort of a very difficult concept to even look into, because you've got all these people who are now looking at it, but they're all working from something that's a translation of something that wasn't even particularly precise to begin with.
So it ended up being this folklore, but that a lot of people took for granted as a proven scientific thing.
I think so, yeah. I mean, a lot of the scientists that I talked to for this were surprised at how little research had been done into it. A lot of them talked about how when they got interested, the first thing you do is you look up to see what other people have done before you. And more than one of them said they were totally shocked that very little, in fact, had been done before them, and that people had just sort of accepted this as something that was true.
So are these scientists that you talk to, are they trying to study this concept, and how do you do that?
Yeah, they're definitely trying, and it's very hard. A lot of it has to do with really setting definitions properly and figuring out what it is you're even studying to begin with, right? You need to know what you're measuring before you can measure it. And anytime you're trying to measure something like that weird feeling you get, you know, even when you or I were to try to describe it, we're just sort of like, I don't know, I just don't like it, you know, so it's hard to, as a scientist, put, you know, data on that. So there's a couple of ways that they'll do it. What they'll do is they'll show people sort of a progression of images, and they'll take, on the one side, they'll have very cartoon blob thing, and on the other side, they'll have a picture of a human, and then they'll kind of morph that into 10, 20 different little images, and they'll ask people to kind of rate their reaction to each one. And the idea being that it somewhere in the middle there, as you go from this cartoon character to a human, you're going to see that dip in likability, in our reaction. And that's one way they do it. And they've tried to do this with monkeys and with babies, even, to try to figure out whether this is sort of an inherent revulsion that we have, or whether it's tied up in sort of the way we find we're afraid of robots culturally or things like that. So that's one way they'll do it. A lot of it is just showing people pictures of things. And this is what Moore even proposed. You know, he showed a picture of a wooden hand, which in the 70s was like pretty uncanny to people, which now we would find sort of normal. And he proposed even showing people. So a lot of it is showing people pictures or having them interact with robots and responding to them, which makes it hard because we humans are not very good at providing very accurate data for scientists about how we're feeling.
Yeah, this subject 13 has a creeped out factor of 0.73. That's probably a phrase you didn't come across a lot. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
You mentioned the idea of this being inherent, and that's why they're trying to study on babies, versus something that we pick up and culturally learn. Is it possible that this we might have had this aversion when we first saw a robot or a really lifelike motion-captured animated character, but we're going to get used to it and get over it?
Yeah, so scientists are split on that. Some people say that, you know, we're going to be able to make robots that are so lifelike, that are so human, that we don't even know that they're robots. And this is sort of the classic sci-fi scenario, right? You have robots among us and we don't know who they are. And there are some scientists who say we're going to get that good at it. And then once we do, all of this sort of weirdness that comes from robots, which a lot of it they say is sort of, it's so close yet not quite there, and our reaction is almost one of like, maybe that's a sick individual, maybe that's an individual that I don't want to be near because they might give me some sort of disease. That as soon as we get good at making robots move like humans and look like humans, we're just going to get over this whole thing and it won't even be an issue. The other camp says no. Just like, you know, if you're an expert in something, you can get really, really good at telling the difference between tiny factors, you know, biologists who can tell the difference between all the different kinds of insects, and you and I have no idea, they just look like bugs. They're saying, you know, because being able to identify something as human is pretty important to us as humans, we're going to just keep up and we'll just be able to figure it out. And there will never be that moment where we can just look at something that's a robot and say, oh, yes, it's a robot, it's almost like a human, but I'm fine with it. That they argue that we're always going to be able to know when something is a robot.
Well, here's an interesting thought, or I think it's interesting. Are we going to learn things from these robot and animated character studies that then tell us things about how we recognize other actual humans? Can we feed that research back?
I think so. And I think a lot of people who study how, especially how babies start to learn what's a human face and what's not a human face, a lot of the studies are quite similar. You know, you show a baby a human face and then you show it a not human face. And that's also how we look at whether or not they're registering this uncanny valley feeling. And I think that for a lot of people, there are a lot of interesting components to this. Like, for example, one of the robots that I got to look at is named Casper 2, and he's a child robot. So like doubly creepy for most of us. But for a lot of kids, he's not creepy at all. And that's really interesting to scientists, you know, and especially because Casper 2 is a robot that's designed to work with autistic children. And autistic children respond really well to this robot. So that's interesting. So there's a lot of things that we can learn, I think, from the way that we respond to these robots about how, not only how we interact with other humans, but also how we interact with technology and how we're changing the way that we feel, how comfortable we feel with like a robot being in the room.
So you've been researching the robots, the movies. Is there a case of one that you personally, Rose, were a little creeped out by?
I think a lot of them were creepy at the beginning to me. Casper was a good example. When I first saw him, I was like, oh, I don't like that. But as soon as you sort of get used to it, and it only takes a few minutes of looking at it or watching a video of it, it sort of goes away. And a lot of robot designers that I talked to said that, you know, even the man who built Casper, who sort of turned him on for the first time, said that even he, after working with him all these years or all this time to build it, was a little bit creeped out by Casper when he started moving. But then you get over it. So for me, there were a lot of robots that I saw that I thought were creepy and then sort of no longer were creepy. And I think that might be something that just sort of happens culturally as well, is we just get, we're so used to seeing robots, if we get good at building them, we're so used to seeing them all the time that eventually we just sort of stop feeling that sort of revulsion and being creeped out by them.
Rose, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rose Eveleth. She's a writer, producer, and designer based in Brooklyn. Her piece, Robots, Is the Uncanny Valley Real?, appeared on BBC.com. We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, our news guy Noah Ovshinsky is here to bring us up to speed on the state's top news stories. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.